Good morning, and thanks a lot, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be invited to speak at this conference and to share some of my observations and writings and research findings regarding the feasibility of meeting expanded ethanol targets and the impact of meeting those targets on fuel prices. EPA's proposal to reduce ethanol mandates, as Jeff indicated, to about 13 billion gallons, as I read it, it seems to be predicated on two beliefs. The first is that consumers will not consume more ethanol than contained in E10. I think you heard that opinion very eloquently explained by a Marathon speaker. So that's the first idea. The second idea is that if EPA tries to force ethanol consumption beyond E10 levels, then retail fuel prices will increase significantly. I think you also heard that from the Marathon speaker in terms of their choice whether to export gasoline and that the RIN value is a marginal cost to them, incremental cost of production. And I think both of these beliefs have been reinforced by extensive lobbying campaigns by the oil industry trade groups and executives. And I read those like all of you did, and I started wondering if there was really any economic validity to these arguments. And so I got a smart colleague of mine, Sebastian Pouliot, who's an assistant professor and smarter than me about how to model things and how to create data. And I'm a little smarter than him on what we ought to be thinking about. So we wrote a series of research papers to look at whether or not there is actually any validity to these beliefs. And so what I want to do today is kind of summarize some of the findings. I think some of our research paper was referred to earlier as billions of gallons of E85 could just magically be consumed by consumers, and I think you'll see what I hope to do is you get a better appreciation for some of the work that we did on that. The big green arrow, that makes sense, isn't it? Okay, so let's get started here. So I think Jeff did a good idea. So let's just start with fundamentals so that when I get into a little bit more, we know we're all on the same level. So how is the RFS supposed to work? The first thing is a clear roadmap. Make everyone, and I think if all of you have ever gone to any RFS lecture, you've seen the volume mandates go up almost in a linear fashion until they hit 15 billion gallons and then they're flat. And then cellulosic is supposed to take after. But there is no surprise since the Energy Act was passed that 14.4 billion gallons was the target in 2014 and 15 billion gallons was the target in 2015. This was supposed to signal to everybody that these are the targets and it's the law of the land. So a clear signal about what the blending targets are supposed to be has been a key part of the RFS. Flexibility was also part of the RFS, and it included both volume flexibility in case the supply of fuel wasn't as great as potentially as envisioned back in 2007. And clearly the cellulosic production of biofuel has trailed badly, not badly, but it's trailed significantly. So the reality is different. The reality of the volumes are much lower than what the targets were. But EPA has in the RFS the authority to have flexibility to reduce those volume mandates. So that flexibility is key. The other flexibility that's key is that the Congress passed a market-based mechanism to create the incentives for investment that would then, and consumption and investment, to allow the clear targets to be met. And that's the market for RINs. EPA, in that market for RINs, also the flexibility in banking RINs to carry over, like Jeff indicated, or borrowing RINs from the future in case the compliance costs were too high. So clear roadmap, flexibility on volumes, and flexibility in a market-based mechanism was how the RFS was supposed to work. It's envisioned that that's the way it's supposed to work. So, a little bit of theory. I'm an economist, so we have to have a little theory here. So here is, for those of you wondering, what is all this RIN value and how does RIN create incentive? So the theory of the RIN is that a RIN price closes any gap between the price that is needed to get consumers to want to consume ethanol, the demand pull model. So the RIN price, so there is a price of ethanol where consumers will want to buy it. So if that price is lower than the cost of producing ethanol and getting it to the consumer, the RIN value is supposed to close that gap. It does close that gap. That's the theory of RIN value. So anything that changes that gap will change the RIN value. So high production costs of corn ethanol, that'll increase the RIN value. Low production costs will reduce it. High consumer demand will decrease the RIN value. Low consumer demand will increase it. That's the theory. That's how RINs are supposed to work. So I give an example, a concrete example, because a lot of what I've found or based my research on is this relationship between the RIN value, the production cost of ethanol, and the demand for ethanol. So I got an example here. And my example is, suppose that we have an E10 price of $3.30 per gallon. That's a pump price that consumers pay at the pump. And now, further suppose, and I'm using an E85 example here, suppose that you're an owner of a flex vehicle, and to make it worth your while to fill that flex vehicle up with E85, and you happen to have an E85 station available to you, that you want that E85 priced at $2.55 a gallon. Okay, so that's a retail price of E85, and you'll go and fill up your tank with E85. And if I assume there's a 75 cent wholesale to retail markup, and what that means is that the blender needs ethanol priced inexpensively at the wholesale level. That blender needs $1.55 ethanol to create a low enough price of E85, wholesale price of E85, to be able to sell it to the retail outlet at $2.55 to get the consumer to buy the E85. Okay? So we need $1.55 ethanol. And I'm going to assume throughout this, economists, they without assumptions, we'd be dead. But I'm going to assume that markets are competitive. I don't know any of you out there who don't think that you're not in a competitive industry. And so it's a pretty a safe assumption, I think, that we're competitive markets. Okay, so what I did then is calculate how one goes about making E85 price competitive so that the consumer will demand the fuel. And so you do that through D6 RIN values. So what I have on the horizontal axis there, hope you can see that, is that that's the cost of producing and transporting ethanol to a blender who creates the E85. Okay, and then on the vertical axis is the RIN price. And to remind you, we need a pump price of $2.55 and an E10 price of $3.30. So let's consider an example. Let's suppose that corn fell in price dramatically to, say, $3.50 a gallon. Essentially, that would mean that you could get corn ethanol to the blender at $1.50. Well, $1.50 is less than that $1.55 that you need the E85 to be priced at, so the RIN value is zero. More realistically, let's say that ethanol, the cost of producing and transporting ethanol is $1.75. That corresponds to more like $4.10 corn, something like that. Then you need a RIN value of 20 cents to make E85 competitive. It closes that gap. Then at $2 corn, I think that's probably where, $2 corn, I'm sorry. Heaven forbid we go to $2 corn, except for the ethanol plants, they might make a little money. But $2 ethanol, then that corresponds, and I think that's about where we are today, $2 to $2.20. That corresponds to RIN values between 45 and 65 cents. So again, there's an inverse relationship between the cost of production of ethanol and the RIN value needed to induce the drivers of E85 to demand the fuel. So I just set this up because this is how the market for RINs works, how the theory of RIN value determination works, and this is how the demand is supposed to materialize for E85 is through the RIN value. And I think Jeff's graph in Minnesota illustrated this. So there's some key questions that I tried to address in my research. It's, can ethanol consumption be increased through E85, or is it a failed fuel? I don't think it's a failed fuel. I don't think it's been priced right. Well, what price of E85 is needed to get consumers to buy it? And how much ethanol can actually be feasibly consumed at E85 given the current infrastructure and given investment? So share some findings with you. So the first question is, we cannot go back in time to look at the data to show whether or not consumers will buy E85 for the simple reason that E85 has not been priced at a level to get consumers to want to buy it. Those consumers with flex vehicles, if they even see an E85 station, the price historically, as we see here in Minnesota, has been priced above the level that is needed to make sense for them to buy the fuel. The red line here is the fuel cost parity line, which is the price of E85 relative to E10, where it breaks even in terms of miles per gallon. As you can see, even in Minnesota, the E85 price for almost the whole time period has been above the price where it makes sense for consumers to buy it. If you want consumers to buy something, you got to make it a good deal for them. You need that blue line to go below the fuel cost parity line, or at least equal to it. So instead of looking at Minnesota data, what we did is we went to a place where consumers are used to making a choice between high blends, in fact, 100% blends, and gasoline or lower blends. And that's in Brazil. So what I have here is a curve that basically shows the willingness or proclivity of Brazilians to buy E100. So on the horizontal axis, you didn't know you were going to have to get into a lot of charts here, but on the horizontal axis is that fuel cost ratio. And that's the fuel cost ratio, the price of E100 divided by the price of gasoline in Brazil, and it's adjusted for miles per gallon. So when you're above one, that means ethanol is more expensive. And then on the vertical axis is the proportion of people, of Brazilians, who buy E100. So as ethanol costs you money to fill up, fewer Brazilians buy it. No surprise. As the price of ethanol drops relative to gasoline, you get a tremendous response of people who do buy it, and you can see that we can draw the fuel parity line at one. About 40% of flex fuel vehicle owners in Brazil will buy E100 when it's priced at parity. If it's priced below parity, you can see the dramatic upswing in the demand for the fuel. When ethanol is priced below parity, you can see that people won't buy it. So it's really, price is a key feature, which to an economist makes sense, right? If you want someone to buy your product, price it where it makes sense for them to buy it. So what we did, of course, is we wanted to look at the potential demand. Well, the potential demand for E85 is zero if you don't own a flex vehicle. So the first step we had to do was go and find where the flex vehicles were. So this is a zip code map of where the flex vehicles were. And to make it easier, what I did is I created a state-by-state number where the flex vehicles are. For in the United States, if you wanted to sell E85, one would think that you would want to go where the consumers are. Well, the consumers are in Texas, California, Florida, Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, so you see some big Midwestern states there, but the number three The top three states for flex vehicle owners are Texas, California, and Florida. Then after you get past the big Midwestern, the manufacturing belt, you see New York, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Georgia, North Carolina. Not exactly E85 places where there's lots of E85 stations. So what we wanted to do is be realistic about matching up where the cars are, the flex vehicles are, and where the stations are. So, but the first thing we wanted to do was, let's suppose that E85 was as widely available as E10. And you priced it accordingly. What this curve shows is that if you price E85 at fuel cost parity, and E85 is as widely available as E10, we calculate that you'd get about 2.5 billion gallons of ethanol consumption in E85. Now, why 2.5 billion gallons is important? Remember, if E10 is 13 billion gallons, 13.4 according to Jeff, but 13, the target's 15, you can see that 2.5, it could get you there. And if you lowered the price to make it a good deal for consumers, you could get up to 6 billion gallons. Maybe this is what the graph that was referred to as billions of gallons of consumption. But if we then look at the reality, E85 is not available everywhere. You can see it's mostly available up in the upper Midwest. If you go to where the flex vehicles are, Florida, Texas, and California, there's very few E85 stations available, and they haven't priced it at anywhere near the price that is needed to get those owners of flex fuel vehicles to buy it. So what we did is that we calculated the distance from every flex fuel station to every flex fuel vehicle to every flex E85 station, and we calculated there's about 5 million FFVs within 5 miles of a station. So those are kind of the feasible set of flex vehicles that could potentially purchase E85. And then we looked at the reality of how much volume of E85 could go through the system, and we came up with this demand chart. This is the amount of ethanol that could be consumed in E85 with no investment in new infrastructure and no new flex fuel vehicles. And you see at about, if you priced it at parity, we estimate about 600 million gallons. If you discounted it, you can see that you could get up to 800 million gallons. So essentially, which agrees with what Jeff put out there, it's completely feasible to meet a 14.4 billion gallon mandate with about 700 million gallons of E85, if it was priced accordingly, without any new investment. But of course, if you priced it accordingly, low, you would get excess demand. And so what if we needed to go beyond that? Well, it would make sense for fuel retailers to invest in E85 in places where the flex fuel vehicles are. So what we did is we identified where demand for E85 could materialize, and you can see that if we wanted to optimize where you would put the stations, you would put them in the places where the flex fuel vehicles were. So then we said, okay, well, the RFS is supposed to force investment. If this is the type of investment in fuel distribution for E85 that we could get, what would be the impact on demand? So we said, okay, let's put on 500 stations, 1,000 stations, 1,500 and 3,500 stations, and let's price the fuel so it makes sense for consumers to buy it. So you can see the last chart, the last line there shows you the amount of ethanol that could be consumed if you put 3,500 new E85 stations in locations where the flex vehicles were. And you can see that we calculate at parity, or if you price it a little bit below parity, you could get 2 billion gallons of E85 consumed. Again, the consumption would follow the investment. The question becomes, why will these new stations magically appear? You heard our previous speaker, consumers don't want the fuel. Well, it's the RFS is supposed to work to create the incentive for investment to take place to create the demand. So, and that's done through RIN prices. So high RIN prices, just like any other high corn prices, create an incentive to get more RINs. Well, how do you get more RINs? The two fuels that are out there, E85 and E15. So you So to get more wins, you have to get stimulate more consumption. So the value of the wins generated by inducing more consumption is much, much greater than the cost of investment by our calculations. So the RIN market creates the incentives by having the refineries try to avoid compliance costs with the RFS to reduce their compliance costs by investing in the infrastructure needed to lower the RIN value and increase demand for the fuels. That's how the RFS is supposed to work. The E10 infrastructure build-out is the model. Before 2005 and 2006, we had another blend wall. It was the E5 blend wall or the E6 blend wall. That is, vast parts of the country could not consume E10. How did that infrastructure get built out? Because there was an incentive to create the infrastructure, and instead of a high RIN price creating the incentive, it was a tax credit, and the VTEC created the incentive. It's the same idea with the new infrastructure. Okay, so last thing I want to do is look at the impact of RIN prices on consumers and refineries. So I agree 100% with our previous speaker that RIN values are an incremental cost of production to refineries. And here's the cost increase. You calculate it as the RVO percentage times the RIN price. For example, 11-cent cost increase would be an 11% RVO times a dollar RIN price. So keep the round number. So it is an 11-cent increase in RIN value or production cost. That cost increase, as any cost increase will do to a refinery, will reduce the supply of gasoline that refineries provide. That reduction in supply will cause wholesale gasoline prices to rise by less than the cost increase. We calculate about 8 cents. So about 8 cents, a dollar RIN would translate into about an 8 cent increase in wholesale gasoline prices. I think this is consistent with the story that we were just told. The problem is that consumers, if you look at the impact on consumers, they don't consume pure gasoline. They consume E10. And so the gasoline component increases by about 7 cents a gallon. I know I'm getting a little caught in the weeds here. But remember that dollar RIN is creating lower cost ethanol for consumers. And a 10% blend, a dollar RIN, I can do the arithmetic, 0.1 times a dollar, that lowers the price of E10 by 10 cents. So you got gasoline price go up, ethanol down, the net effect on the gasoline price is a slight decrease in the E10 price from, ironically, a $1 increase in RINs. That's the way it's supposed to work, and that's the way we think that it would work. So here's we think that, in fact, you even when you have a RIN value going up, as the lower chart shows, we would see the retail price of gasoline staying constant. So that's what I wanted to say. Just want to conclude that I think that we're at a key turning point, and I think if the administration is serious about increasing the amount of renewable fuels, now is the time to do it. If they ever think that Congress is going to pass a law that is requiring investment to be made in the future, and if they allow the blend wall to determine the level of ethanol that will be consumed domestically, then we can just multiply the total gasoline consumption by 10% and then just freeze the mandate there and then go about our business by looking at alternative markets. I think that if the Congress and administration want to follow the fact that we want to replace fossil gasoline with renewable fuels, I think EPA really needs to revisit this this mandate just to maintain credibility with the laws that they pass in the future. With that, I think that was a pretty well summarized what I've found out.
As Stefan makes his way to the podium, I'm just going to let folks know that we will have some time for your questions. following Dr. Mueller's presentation. So if you have some questions for Professor Babcock or Stephen Mueller, be thinking of those, and we'll entertain a few questions. Go ahead, Stephen.
Okay. So press the green button here. Take mine.